So as we just heard in that report, one reason everyone has been watching this Senate race is because a victory by Franken gives the Democrats a 60th senator. And in theory, that should end any chance Republicans would have to hold up legislation through the filibuster. But there is, of course, a difference between theory and reality. And who better to give us a dose of reality than NPR's political editor, Ken Rudin. Good morning, Ken.
Comparing Ken Rudin and reality in the same sentence is kind of interesting.
I won't even go there. This story is probably giving you a lot of material. You're going to miss it a little bit?
Well, Minnesota voters certainly won't. It's exciting to watch. It's not the worst thing in the world to have it fight out in the courts. But ultimately, I think people were tiring of it. And the state Supreme Court was the final say.
So this magic 60, the magic number 60, Al Franken sort of downplayed it. He said it's not as magical as some people say. How important is it for Democrats to have those 60 votes?
Well, they have 60 seats, and they have the 58 Democrats, and they have two independents, Joe Lieberman and Bernie Sanders, who vote with the Democrats, but they won't necessarily have 60 votes. Ben Nelson of Nebraska strays from the party line quite a bit. We saw Evan Bayh of Indiana vote against the Obama budget measure, among other things. Joe Lieberman often breaks from party orthodoxy on foreign policy issues. It remains to be seen if Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus and the Obama administration see eye to eye on health care. And nobody knows for sure how reliable Arlen Specter, the new Democrat, is going to be for Harry Reid and the Democratic leadership. Plus, Ted Kennedy and Robert Byrd have missed a lot of votes this year because of health issues, so we don't know that the long-range prognosis for them. A lot of it depends on the issue. To say that the Republicans are completely impotent or the Democrats have no worries, I think that would be incorrect.
And missing a vote because of illness, that could be the end of stopping filibuster.
Well, obviously, you still need the 60 votes to stop the filibuster. And while you'll have 60 votes, you have to have all 60 voting on the same page. And that's not always easy to do for the Democrats.
Well, take us back in history. When was the last time either party had these 60 seats in the Senate?
Democrats had 61 votes as recently as 1978. It was during the Jimmy Carter administration. But if you remember back then, most of them fought among themselves than anything else. John Cornyn, the senator from Texas, said yesterday, that now the onus is on the Democrats to produce. Be careful what you wish for. Now, I would rather have, if I were a Democrat, I'd rather have 60 votes than 51 votes, say. But again, you know, you just be careful what you wish for, because it may turn out to bite you in the end.
So one thing that struck me in Tom Weber's piece that we just heard was Al Franken saying, you know, I am just the second senator from Minnesota, really downplaying his role in Washington. I mean, he's known as being quite a personality. I mean, what are you expecting? I mean, being sort of the quiet worker for a while, or is he going to make some noise when he gets here?
Well, ultimately, he will make noise because he is Al Franken. But I think his strategy was very smart during the entire recount. He was uncharacteristically low-key. Remember, Barack Obama carried Minnesota by some 300,000 votes last year. Al Franken won by 312 votes. So it appears the Democrats were not wild about him, and he may have some fence mending to do. But, you know, it's tough to come into the Senate 6 months after the session started. Although he's already hired staff, it shouldn't take him long. There's some talk that he may get on Senate Judiciary Committee, and if he does, he may have an opportunity to attract some notice during the Sotomayor confirmation hearings.
Could Democrats be a little leery of having a comedian in their ranks?
Well, there are a lot of comedians in politics, as we've seen in South Carolina and Nevada in the last couple of days. But again, 60 votes is far better than 58 or 56.
Well, what's next for Norm Coleman, the Republican who lost this race in very small numbers? We heard in the earlier piece that he's thinking about a run for governor.
Well, you know, his name is certainly out there, and I suspect that if he is going to run for governor next year, perhaps that's one of the reasons he ended his challenge after only 238 days. But remember, he ran for governor once before in 1998. He lost to Jesse Ventura. So when you think of it, he's lost first to a wrestler and now to a comedian. I don't think that looks great on your resume. And perhaps Minnesota Republicans may be looking for a new candidate, but 2010 is a long way, you know, off down the line.
But very briefly, Ken, one of the early reactions from Republicans is that they're a little frightened about the Democrats having these numbers. Does this force them into a new position now?
Well, look, first of all, you could look at it another way, that the Democrats don't have to compromise now that they have the votes. Republicans are still looking for a strategy to battle Barack Obama. And, of course, it's tougher with only 40 votes now out of the 100-vote Senate.
Ken, thanks as always.
Thank you, David.
That is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. His political junkie blog can be found if you go to our website, npr.org/junkie.
while ago on this program, we marked the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's sonnets.
Which gave us a pretty good excuse to say things like, make thee another self for love of me, that beauty still may live in thine or thee.
Ah, well, it also gave us an excuse to think about the next 400 years. Could any words of love from our time possibly last as long as Shakespeare's poetry?
And so we put that question to you, our listeners.
We invited you to suggest a modern love poem or song that's good enough, enduring enough, to be remembered 400 years from now.
And several hundred people sent in suggestions. Turns out a lot of you are Dylan fans.
I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Of the great love music, you also recommended The Beatles' In My Life, Janis Joplin with Me and Bobby McGee, Leonard Cohen, Joan Baez.
You folks are an eclectic bunch. You also voted for the love lyrics of Billy Idol, The Smashing Pumpkins, Pearl Jam, and 50 Cent.
And some of you waxed poetic about plain old poetry. One listener suggested this elegant little love note written by Billy Collins.
I want to carry you. And for you to carry me, the way voices are said to carry over water. Just this morning on the shore, I could hear two people talking quietly in a rowboat on the far side of the lake. They were talking about fishing. Then one changed the subject, and I swear they began talking about you.
Now, you could argue that a poem like that might never last 400 years because it's not sad enough.
Which brings us to this excerpt from a poem that has a very sad title, W.H. Auden's Funeral Blues.
He was my north, my south, my east and west, my working week and my Sunday rest, my noon, my midnight, my talk, my song. I thought that love would last forever. I was wrong.
You know, you might remember that from the film Four Weddings and a Funeral. And in fact, many of you did suggest great romantic dialogue from the movies, though who knows if the movies will even exist in 400 years, but still.
But listeners were happy to suggest some of the usual suspects, like Casablanca.
Here's Looking at You, Kid.
We'll always have Paris.
Also in the movie category, there are some surprising choices, like Jerry Maguire.
Jerry Maguire, as in, show me the money, Renee!
No, David, as in, you had me at hello.
Okay. Yes, hello. Sorry.
Not exactly Shakespeare, but that scene kept coming up from a lot of people.
And we know there are a lot more ideas out there, and you haven't missed your shot. Just go to npr.org if you'd like to submit some more ideas. You just have to click on the words Summer of Love.
We are looking for words of romance that might last, get this, the next 400 years.
But for the next few seconds, music be the food of love. So play on.
Rising costs and fears of rationing were two things I discussed yesterday on the program with a pair of veteran doctors. Today, we'll hear perspectives on health care and primary care in particular from two young doctors who've just finished up residencies in internal medicine. Brian Southern started out thinking he wanted to be a primary care doctor. It was a childhood dream. But he changed his mind during his residency at the University Hospital's Case Medical Center in Cleveland. Nicole Loading wasn't sure where she was headed when she began her residency at the University of California, San Diego, but she found what she enjoyed most was building relationships with patients over time, and that led her to primary care.
A big part of it is that you have this relationship almost to the point where sometimes the patients come in and it's almost like you're seeing one of your friends again, and they know about your family and your pets and you know about theirs, and you build that trust so then when there are important things, they feel comfortable telling you when they have a problem or something's concerning to them or something's important to them, to be able to filter out and be able to take care of the things that are urgent healthcare matters and to kind of help filter through and prioritize and accomplish goals, you know, for both you and the patient.
Now, Brian Southern, you've made a different decision. You are going to be specializing in pulmonary critical care. Why did you decide to specialize, not go into primary care?
Well, since I can remember, I always wanted to do primary care for many of the reasons that Nicole mentioned, but my experience was a little bit different. I felt rushed all the time, and I felt like I had to see so many patients, and I had to meet certain criteria, such as getting their blood pressure below a certain level, and I didn't really have time to talk to the patients, to interact with them, to listen to them. So I really became disillusioned with primary care not too long after starting my residency.
Well, Dr. Loading, what about what Dr. Southern was just talking about there? And you do hear complaints from doctors all the time that they don't have enough time to spend with their patients. They would probably say you have a very starry-eyed view of what your practice is going to end up being.
Right. And I think there's certainly challenges. I'm kind of lucky in that the clinic that I've had the last 3 years and the clinic that I'm going to join this fall, they do have 20-minute visit slots with patients, which is not a great amount of time, but enough that I'm hoping to be able to prioritize. And you may only be able to focus on one or two things each visit, but get done what you can in the visit, get done what's most urgent. And then also I think some of it will need to be a greater role of support staff. Take care of what can be done on the phone with your nurses or your NPs. Do the things that can be done outside of the office visit. And I do think it will be challenging.
As you both were going through medical school and then into your residencies, is there a stigma attached to primary care? Did you feel that and hear that from people, Dr. Southern?
I think so. I know that I was in the minority when, you know, I voiced my interest in primary care. And often it wouldn't be directly said, but I would, you know, feel that people looked down on me a bit because I showed an interest in primary care.
What did you hear specifically from people?
Well, you know, I heard things like, do you know how much money a primary care doctor makes and how are you going to pay your medical school loans with that type of salary, and you know, with the way things are going with healthcare in this country, you're referring patients most of the time, and you know, those were just not things that I wanted to do.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Loading, I heard you laughing in there as Dr. Southern was talking, but the pay gap is a real concern, I would think. I mean, I was looking at one study that showed the average annual income for a family doctor, $173,000, for a cardiologist, $419,000. Do you think about
there
that?
There is a significant gap. I think you have to be honest with yourself and say, what am I going to enjoy doing? And I'm not a procedure person. The technical aspects of doing a cardiac catheterization or a colonoscopy, it's not something that I enjoy or that I think I would want to do for the rest of my life.
How important was quality of life when you thought about what kind of doctor you want to be?
It was quite a consideration. I prefer to work during the daytime. I'm not really a night person, so I didn't want to have to be called in and go into the hospital in the middle of the night to either admit a patient or do a procedure or take the patient to the OR. So it was important to me to have more of a regular, kind of predictable, kind of normal daytime hour schedule that I could be with my family and doing things that I enjoy in the evenings and the weekends. So that was a big factor for me.
Dr. Southern, how did quality of life factor into your decision?
Well, it factored in, but, you know, in the opposite regard. I love being in the hospital. I love waking up at 3 a.m. and having to deal with an acute crisis. Those are the types of things that really appealed to me in pulmonary and critical care medicine.
Dr. Southern, do you think there would be anything that could be done that would make primary care more attractive to you, steer you away from specializing and into primary care?
Well, you know, to be honest, this is one of the reasons I chose critical care and pulmonary medicine. I know a lot of pulmonary and critical care doctors who ultimately go back to primary care. The big problem that I had with primary care was the time constraints, pay for performance measures that are becoming more and more common, where you are essentially graded on certain criteria. Did you meet a blood pressure goal? Did you meet a blood sugar goal? And I felt like that was not what I wanted to do. I felt like, you know, medicine is composed of science and art. And I felt like the art of medicine, which is what I loved about medicine, is being taken away by these things. And I think that if we're going to judge doctors, part of what they're judged on is patient satisfaction. And did the patient feel like you listened to their concerns? And was the patient able to talk about all of the problems that he was having? And, you know, I feel like if somehow we could get back to that, then primary care would be much more appealing for people like me who enjoy the art of medicine.
Well, Dr. Southern and Dr. Loading, thanks very much and best of luck to you both.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Brian Southern has just started a fellowship in pulmonary critical care at the University Hospital's Case Medical Center in Cleveland. Nicole Loading will join a primary care practice in Minneapolis this fall. And one last note from a healthcare veteran, one of the doctors we heard on the program yesterday, family physician Greg Darrow. He talked about the ways in which the healthcare system can whirl the mind of young doctors, and I asked if he had any advice for the doctors you just heard from.
Always you need to be an advocate for your patient and to realize that no matter what corporation it is, the most important relationship is the one in that room with that patient. To be an advocate for that patient and to always look out for the welfare of that person in front of you.
You can hear my earlier conversation with Dr. Darrow and surgical oncologist George Kinesi at our website, npr.org. If you are struggling to make payments on your federal student loan, you can breathe a little easier today. You can now apply for a program that bases your monthly payments on your income and family size. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
25-year-old Chanel Schneider sells lotions, soaps, and perfumes at a suburban mall near her home in Gaithersburg, Maryland.
I work part-time, 15 to 20 hours a week.
That's about $600 to $700 in take-home pay every month. Her college loan payments, though, are over $800 a month. Schneider's total debt, not counting interest, is $67,000 in private and federal student loans. After 6 years of college in pursuit of a double major, she's 2 credits shy of her degree, but can no longer afford college.
So I had to leave. And I came out of a high school as a 4.0 student. So this wasn't supposed to happen to me, you know? I was supposed to go to college, graduate in 4 years, and get a job.
In her current job, though, Schneider can't possibly make her payments. This is where the income-based repayment plan kicks in. It'll help her with the $22,000 she owes in federal loans. Because her monthly payments exceed her income, Schneider won't have to pay a dime, zero, until she earns more money, of course. Once her income begins to climb, the new plan sets a cap on what Schneider's maximum payment will be every month, roughly 15% of her discretionary income. And if she's still making payments 25 years down the road, the government will forgive the balance and interest on her loans.
It provides a light at the end of the tunnel so that your student debt won't follow you to the grave.
That's Lauren Asher, president of the Institute for College Access and Success. Her organization and the U.S. Department of Education have each put up a calculator on their websites to help people figure out if the new income-based repayment plan is for them.
A good rule of thumb, if you want to know whether you'd be eligible for income-based repayment, is that if you owe at least as much as you earn, you probably qualify.
Let's say a student borrowed $30,000 and is now earning about $25,000 a year, says Asher. Under the income-based repayment plan, his monthly payments would drop from $345 to $110 a month. That's typical for students with mostly federal loans, but the plan doesn't cover private loans. Take, for example, Brittany Taylor. She has a master's in music from the University of Miami and is earning about $1,600 a month working for a nonprofit arts program in Orlando, Florida. She borrowed $85,000, mostly in private loans. Her lender is Sallie Mae.
I'm paying $265 a month. And I was like, how can we work this out? And I basically begged, you know, on the phone, I'm sure other students have had to do it too, to where I can get this, you know, into a reasonable payment every month.
Maybe then she could begin paying back her federal loans, says Taylor, not just her private loans. There are lots of students like Taylor, says Lauren Asher.
And unfortunately, people who have private loans, and that's a growing proportion of undergraduates, have risky, usually variable rate loans that are more like a credit card or a subprime mortgage than student aid. And they are generally at the mercy of their lenders in terms of repayment options.
Still, says Asher, the income-based repayment plan is a huge step towards a more reasonable loan repayment policy. The question is whether Congress and the Obama administration will move to include private loans in that policy. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
Here's one example of the confusion with this ongoing story. Today we called the Honduran embassy here in Washington to find the ambassador. We reached a minister at the embassy, Rodolfo Pastor, and he told us the ambassador is no longer the ambassador. But we then reached that ambassador, Roberto Flores Bermudez, and he told us he has not yet received any notification of a change in his status. Mr. Flores Bermudez was called back to Honduras for consultations with the new government. He spoke with us from the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa, and he told us his loyalties are to his country.
President Zelaya appointed me to Washington, D.C., and of course I have participated with him on many missions. And what has happened now is that there has been a change of government, and from what I have been hearing, it has been a due process of law that has taken place.
Did you say it has been a due process of law or undue process?
I said a due process of law. As far as I can tell, the constitutional order of the country was never interrupted, and the application of the laws of Honduras have been fulfilled. And this is what I'm learning here, and there is the need for the international community to be able to listen to what actually happened here and not just listen to one side, only one of the parties. You have to listen to all sides. This is very important.
So you're saying the coup that ousted President Zelaya in Honduras was legitimate and there is a legitimate government now in place there?
Well, first of all, I was not qualifying what happened as a coup. A coup would mean the disrupture of constitutional order in my country. Mm-hmm. That did not happen. So it's not a coup, it's a constitutional procedure to remove from office a president that had been in breach of law. The procedure took place, a commission was established by the Congress according to procedure. The report pointed at violation of law by the president, and therefore in application of the constitutional regulations, the decision was adopted by unanimity in the Congress. All of the parties, all of the political parties present in the Honduran Congress voted in favor of separating the president from his office, from his post, and to designate the new president according to the constitutional order, the way the succession should take place.
But, Mr. Ambassador, wasn't President Zelaya removed from office at bayonet point by the military?
There was a legal order by a tribunal of the country because of the violations in which the president had been found to be in breach of the law. There was an order for his detainment or capture. And this order was passed on to the armed forces, as I have been told here, and they carried it out. And it was the armed forces because of the sensitive nature of the action they had to undertake.
Has your mind on what happened there been changed since you got back to Honduras?
Well, actually, what I see that happened here is that the country has been united within a legal framework to change the president. That is what I began to realize as soon as one sees the development of the events, which I granted are confusing. And if you just look at the violent act of taking the president out of the country, yes, you could very easily arrive at that conclusion. But when you take a look at the reasons and the procedure that was employed, the legal procedure within the legislative branch of my country, then yes, that is why I arrive at this conclusion.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you again. This block is a pleasure.
That's the Honduran ambassador to the United States, Roberto Flores Bermudez, speaking with us from Tegucigalpa in Honduras.
These days, just pick your media. You won't find a place to hide. You'll find zombies rising from the dead to greet or maybe eat you. You can kill zombies in video games. You can read zombie poetry, watch Nazi zombies in the film Dead Snow. And if Bill Murray's your thing, well, you can wait for the fall when he plays a zombie in a movie with the oh-so-creative title Zombieland. Beth Accomando of member station KPBS reports on the invasion.
Pop quiz hotshot. What would you do in a zombie outbreak? Don't panic. We have undead experts Kevin Workman and Kirsten Elms here to help. Question number one, how do you become a zombie?
If you're bitten, then in a certain amount of time, you will die and then you will come back from the dead.
Correct. Second question, how do you kill a zombie?
By removing the head or destroying the brain.
Very good. Plus, you get style points if you dispose of them with a chainsaw. And what do zombies need to survive?
Brains.
Brains only.
Yes.
Brains, good. But so are livers, hearts, and intestines.
Rule one for zombies, you have to want to kill people. You have to just want to rip someone's throat out. Doesn't matter if they're your mother or your kid. You just want to rip them to pieces.
George A. Romero defined the modern zombie in his 1968 film, Night of the Living Dead. Now zombies are mounting a full-scale invasion, shuffling aimlessly into every corner of our pop culture. At Borders, zombie literature runs the gamut from the Zombie Survival Guide, to Pride and Prejudice in Zombies, to Zombie Haiku.
My rigor mortis is mainly why I'm slower. And the severed foot.
Staring out from vacant eyes, these undead provide the perfect blank canvas for social commentary.
If you want to be able to tell somebody, hey, I don't like you, and I don't like the way you're running the government, I don't like that your corporation's doing this. If I could tell it through a zombie movie, they're not going to care. They'd be like, oh, it's just a zombie movie.
Phil Luque points out that Romero uses them to comment on racism in Night of the Living Dead, and then reanimated them in Land of the Dead.
Trouble?
In a world where the dead are returning to life, the word trouble loses much of its meaning.
These zombies raged against Dennis Hopper's George Bush-like leader. But zombies took on new meaning in Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead in 2004.
Our zombies are the metaphor for apathy. It's kind of like the great plague is laziness. So it's kind of almost like the zombies represent like sloth.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? If you get cornered, bash them in the head. That seems to work out. Keep together, stay sharp, and follow me.
Bashing zombies is a favorite pastime of video games, such as Resident Evil, Left 4 Dead, and Dead Rising, says Trent Reed.
Zombies aren't alive, so anything that you do to them doesn't really matter. You can kill them in the most ridiculous graphic ways.
And parents don't complain about the carnage, the way they did about killing hookers in Grand Theft Auto. Now, if those had been zombie hookers, it would have been a different story. And watch out for Nazi zombies rising from the grave in Dead Snow and Call of Duty World at War. But no matter what form these reanimated corpses take, just remember, aim for the head. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
And if a Norwegian Nazi zombie movie piques your interest, we've got a review of it and some clips. Go to our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne.